to death, even though death has permitted the one to proceed farther along the pathway of life, has cut off the life of the second in his flower, and has broken off the life of the third at its very beginning. Some get their release at the dinner table. Others extend their sleep into the sleep of death. Some are blotted out during dissipation. Now, contrast with these persons, individuals who have been pierced by the sword, or bitten to death by snakes, or crushed in ruins, or tortured piecemeal out of existence by the prolonged twisting of their sinews. Some of these departures may be regarded as better, some as worse. But the act of dying is equal in all. The methods of ending life are different, but the end is one and the same. Death has no degrees of greater or less, for it has the same limit in all instances, the finishing of life. The same holds true, I assure you, concerning goods. You will find one amid circumstances of pure pleasure, another amid sorrow and bitterness. The one controls the favors of fortune, the other overcomes her onslaughts. Each is equally a good, although the one travels a level and easy road, and the other a rough road. And the end of them all is the same. They are goods. They are worthy of praise. They accompany virtue and reason. Virtue makes all the things that it acknowledges equal to one another. You need not wonder that this is one of our principles. We find mentioned in the works of Epicurus two goods, of which his supreme good, or blessedness, is composed of, namely, a body free from pain, and a soul free from disturbance. These goods, if they are complete, do not increase, for how can that which is complete increase? The body is, let us suppose, free from pain. What increase can there be to this absence of pain? The soul is composed and calm. What increase can there be to this tranquility? Just as fair weather, purified into the purest brilliancy, does not admit of a still greater degree of clearness, so, when a man takes care of his body and of his soul, weaving the texture of his good from both, his condition is perfect, and he has found the consummation of his prayers, if there is no commotion in his soul or pain in his body. Whatever delights fall to his lot over and above these two things do not increase his supreme good. They merely season it, so to speak, and add spice to it. For the absolute good of man's nature is satisfied with peace in the body and peace in the soul. I can show you at this moment, in the writings of Epicurus, a graded list of goods just like that of our own school. For there are some things, he declares, which he prefers should fall to his lot, such as bodily rest free from all inconvenience, and relaxation of the soul as it takes delight in the contemplation of its own goods. And there are other things which, though he would prefer that they did not happen, he nevertheless praises and approves. For example, the kind of resignation, in times of ill health and serious suffering, to which I alluded a moment ago, and which Epicurus displayed on that last and most blessed day of his life. For he tells us that he had to endure excruciating agony from a diseased bladder and from an ulcerated stomach, so acute that it permitted no increase of pain. And yet, he says, that day was nonetheless happy. And no man can spend such a day in happiness unless he possesses the supreme good. We therefore find mentioned, even by Epicurus, those goods which one would prefer not to experience, which, however, because circumstances have decided thus, must be welcomed and approved and placed on a level with the highest goods. We cannot say that the good which has rounded out a happy life, the good for which Epicurus rendered thanks in the last words he uttered, is not equal to the greatest. Allow me, excellent Lucilius, to utter a still bolder word. If any goods could be greater than others, I should prefer those which seem harsh to those which are mild and alluring, and should pronounce them greater. For it is more of an accomplishment to break one's way through difficulties than to keep joy within bounds. It requires the same use of reason, I am fully aware, for a man to endure prosperity well and also to endure misfortune bravely. What man may be just as brave who sleeps in front of the ramparts without fear of danger when no enemy attacks the camp, as the man who, when the tendons of his legs have been severed, holds himself up on his knees and does not let fall his weapons? But it is to the blood-stained soldier returning from the front that men cry, "Well done, thou hero!" And therefore, I should bestow greater praise upon those goods that have stood trial and show courage and have fought it out with fortune. Should I hesitate whether to give greater praise to the maimed and shriveled hand of Mucius than to the uninjured hand of the bravest man in the world? There stood Mucius, despising the enemy and despising the fire, and watched his hand as it dripped blood over the fire on his enemy's altar, until Porsenna, envying the fame of the hero whose punishment he was advocating, ordered the fire to be removed against the will of the victim. Why should I not reckon this good among the primary goods, and deem it in so far greater than those other goods, which are unattended by danger and have made no trial of fortune? As it is a rarer thing to have overcome a foe with a hand lost than with a hand armed. What then, you say? Shall you desire this good for yourself? Of course I shall, for this is a thing that a man cannot achieve unless he can also desire it. Should I desire instead to be allowed to stretch out my limbs for my slaves to massage, or to have a woman, or a man changed into the likeness of a woman, pull my finger joints? I cannot help believing that Mucius was all the more lucky because he manipulated the flames as calmly as if he were holding out his hand to the manipulator. He had wiped out